Story 1. 1 in 10 people between the ages of 25 and 34 actually felt alone during Christmas, compared to 1 in 20 of older people. So even young people are feeling this these days. We're going to talk about that. What causes people to feel lonely, and then what can they do about it?
Yeah, lonely is becoming more and more common for a few reasons, just outside of loss, just with all the social networks, doesn't really connect to our emotional world as much as we think it does. And so then as we have these benchmarks like holidays and these different times where society demands joy, we have a tendency of feeling isolated and feeling lonely, even if there's a million people around us.
Yeah, isn't it sort of ironic, because it's the time of the year where we're all supposed to feel our togetherness and community, and in fact, that can almost exacerbate feelings of loneliness.
No doubt. If I'm alone, definitely, because I'm watching ads or just my own life history, I'm playing back times where I wasn't completely alone.
So what are the different varieties of things that can cause or bring on grief?
Or even a move to a different area, a change in a situation, a divorce, a change in a job. And so we have a present situation, our historical, habitual way of doing things, and then the overwhelming piece of what's that mean in the future if I don't have what I used to have in the past. And so loss can come from loss of time, age, menopause, having a baby. You'd think that that's positive, which it is. But also that's a change in a definition, and maybe I'm not going to the holiday party I used to go to. Getting married is a very positive thing, but in that redefinition, there's usually a certain void of what I used to have while I bridge to the present. The grief process of loss is that redefining to what I am today, and that can leave me very caught in the desert alone for a little while.
Are we getting to the point where maybe we're starting to normalize grief?
I hope so. I moved into grief, loss, and trauma heavily professionally almost 20 years ago, and I've watched it. That was my goal, was that grief is good. Loss is a bummer, and it's going to happen, and grief is good. So we didn't have this resistance to this grief process, and I believe it's because we meshed it with loss, and people don't like loss.
Yeah.
And as we started to let those be separated once again, and letting grief individuate from loss and be a process, no different than if I had a large cut and I'd have a scab and I'd keep it clean and I'd pay attention to it until it turns into a scar of wisdom.
You're so wise, Ted.
I thought maybe a lot of scars, I guess.
I was going to say, what brought you into this field yourself?
My personal motivation over a very short time period. First, I almost died, and then my brother died in a shipwreck up in Alaska. And soon after that, my second daughter was born. And then a year after she was born, my wife was diagnosed with sarcomatoid renal cell carcinoma, which is a heavy-duty cancer that at that time people live for about 7 weeks. And she lived for 2 years, and we went through that whole process and that journey, and then she died. And then about 3 years, 2.5 years after that, my daughters and mother-in-law died in a car crash.
Oh,
so more or less my whole family was taken.
Wow.
And I found myself shattered and destroyed. I was no longer a school teacher. I didn't feel like I was still a dad. Today I do. A husband. Of course, I didn't go back to teaching school. I did a journey, which means I was more or less homeless. And so all the ways I had defined myself were gone. And I was just this naked soul that I had to find the core of that soul to rebuild myself.
Wow.
And so from that journey, I realized I might be able to hand someone a flashlight to realize they're not sick, they're not crazy, they're not alone, and grief is a natural, normal process that includes a lot of permission, and I think the magic is finding ways to be seen, heard, and valued by others as well as by myself. You know, loss is a bummer, but in that process, we have the opportunity to heal things we might not even be aware of. Grief isn't to make sense out of the loss, but to make more sense out of my life.
Wow, that's powerful.
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, I do too. Even when I called the office to talk to your secretary, she said, well, yeah, oh, Ted, oh, he's the grief guy. And I thought, wow, Somebody who calls himself the grief guy has got to know some kind of positive side about this whole thing. and like, oh, he'd love to talk about this. I thought, wow, I'm onto the right guy here. So
I'm glad you commented. So I kind of like it. But yes, I believe so much. Without grief, I know I would not be on this earth. And I don't mean that lightly.
Story two. How did you get involved in social enterprise? What inspired it?
Well, man, as a kid, I grew up in the 60s, and I was very much raised looking directly, almost daily, at people that we acknowledge now, whether it's Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, Dr. King, people who were really influential in my young life, and that sense of what it meant to be an American, committed to making the country a better, stronger place for all. As a young man, I dreamed fervently of opening the greatest nightclub in the world and really pursued that path with great diligence throughout my 20s. But it also happened to coincide with the kind of explosion of homelessness in America. When you think of the homeless, you have at times a stereotype and oftentimes even a bigotry about who's in line and why. And one day I went out to serve people. I came to find many, many men and women who were really super lucid. But I asked two questions. Where does the food come from? And found out it was purchased at a very expensive grocery store. And I thought to myself, dang, part of my industry, hospitality in general, we throw away tons of food every day. And I kept thinking, wow, why doesn't, restaurants have food, but they also have jobs. It would be so fascinating to start kind of a cooking school for the homeless. No one thought it would work. So no one would do it. So in 1989, using food donated, interesting enough, our first pickup of food was George Bush Sr.'s inauguration. So on opening day, we took food from a presidential inauguration to train people for jobs so that while they learned, they could prepare healthy meals for other people who might begin their journey off the street and back into society. And I've been doing it ever since.
And that's DC Kitchen. That
yep.
turned into DC
yeah,
Central
DC Kitchen.
Yeah, DC Kitchen.
So it's just changing the focus a little bit and revealing through the power of food the everyday opportunities that present us if we acknowledge that those men and women have a role to play in our society.
We're talking about a $12 million a year enterprise
yep.
that continues today.
So again, this is the power of a social enterprise, that you have the ability to earn revenue, but you reinvest it back in communities.
Tax revenue, right?
Oh, right.
I mean,
on,
as opposed
yeah.
to prison.
200 men and women went through the program and graduated, and they'll earn $5 million a year in new salaries and pay over $225,000 in payroll taxes year end and year out. And that, versus prison, which costs basically $50,000 to $70,000 per person per year.
So let's talk about the power of the nonprofit sector and the numbers and what that looks like.
I'm glad we're going down this road, because I think many listeners think nonprofit and they think charity. Now, again, I've said, since I got started, charity is more about the redemption of the giver than the liberation of the receiver. So, but if it's done well, everyone rises together, right? Too often we're viewed as either super leftists who want to, basically take the world and drag it into this socialist kind of utopia, or, we're super conservative churches. And the fact is, we are hardworking, industrious, innovative people who just want to make the community better. This is business. This is incredibly smart business. I'm part of a sector that represents the third biggest employer, equal to manufacturing, in a full third of the economy in America. $3 trillion in assets, $350 billion in annual revenue, 14 million employees. We channel the energy of 70 million Americans through volunteerism. And you can't make profit without us. Literally, the nonprofit sector would be on the UN Security Council if we were a country. Yet we don't have a say in the smallest town's economic vision.
And what is the reason for that, the root?
Well, I believe, honestly, if you look at the evolution of the sector, we are the feminized part of the American economy. 7 out of 10 nonprofits are led by or were founded by women. Boils down to economic sexism, that the charities do good work while for-profits drive the economy, is wildly flawed.
Yeah, and you also refer to it as a Me Too movement.
Well, it is.
An extension of the Me Too movement.
Oh, I mean, women outlive men, women outnumber men. I say wrinkles are the new tattoos. This is a moment in which women should rightly confront, ageism and all these other things that hold them back. But let's go back to our talk about the nonprofit sector. You have people looking in the mirror wondering, couldn't I have done more with my life? 99.9% of the people on their deathbed wished. It's just I just wish they left a mark. And I think nonprofits have the ability to channel all of that energy, that deeper hunger. Everyone who came into the kitchens I've worked at came looking for something. They were trying to find that place where they could feel like they were contributing. They were making a difference. Hundreds of millions of people who have this great sense of, you know, I want to make Santa Fe, New Mexico, the United States, the world a better place. Where do I go? Where do I sign up? I'm ready.
Right, and enjoy our jobs and have some purpose.
Yeah. I'm going to be wandering the streets of Santa Fe looking for trouble.
And we're going to be finding you, I promise.
I'll look forward to it.
Story 3. I just want to give you a huge welcome. And if you don't know who and what Casa Milagro is, Meryl, please tell us, what is it?
Casa Milagro is a therapeutic community for 12 adults who previously experienced homelessness and who have a diagnosed mental illness. And we were founded on the premise that belonging and being part of a greater whole and being valued for your individual as well as community contributions are the healing force in terms of people who are struggling with a diagnosis, I have my hands in quotes, of a mental illness.
Yes. So tell me, why do you have your hands in a quote when you say mental illness?
Mental illness is a societal construct. And I believe, particularly in these days, society is mentally ill. And there are scapegoats in every system. And the folks that are given a diagnosis, I believe, are scapegoated by others for some reason to feel separate and therefore superior. And I have that in quotes as well.
Yeah. And what is at the root of that, do you think?
Fear.
Fear.
Absolutely. Fear of other, fear of difference. Anybody who, let's say you're walking down the street and you hear someone talking to themselves, they could be having a conversation with God. They might be, you know, our angels, our psychics, you know, those with the thinnest veils, I believe, are closer to spirit than those of us who have our concerns with how we're going to pay our electric bill and how are we going to, you know, make the next appointment. Right?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a whole other way of being, and unfortunately, our society is systematically designed to have self and other. And I believe that the folks with diagnosed mental illness are in the other category, and that's what keeps us separate. So the idea of Casa Milagro was to bring a community of people together who understand what it is to be living with that stigma and who have not only the capacity to heal themselves, but to contribute to the healing of one another. That's the whole idea. The collaboration, the community agreements, the way we keep our home, everybody's contribution matters.
And you have had now long-term and short-term patients there?
We don't call them patients. Thank you for saying that.
Oh.
No, they are just community members. Probably one of my intentions in opening CASA was to keep people out of mental hospitals.
You know, this is why I wanted to do this show on the holiday. I didn't want to do it as a downer show. I wanted to do it as a show of inspiration and an expression of the true Christmas spirit in the manner that you treat people, and especially the folks that you have staying in the house.
The thing that I'm most proud of is that there's no designation between who lives there and who works there or who comes in as a volunteer. We are all in it together, and that's the point. We have a nonviolent policy, and that includes language. People are not ever to put each other down in any way because, believe me, they've had enough of that before they came to Casa Milagro and enough of being disenfranchised and not accepted. So ours is a climate of acceptance and unconditional positive regard.
What drove you to do this? Most people don't have this kind of drive.
I had a grandmother, my father's mother, who was a Holocaust survivor, was diagnosed with a mental illness. A lot of people who came out of concentration camps and, you know, prisoners of war do have diagnoses, and she was in and out of mental hospitals. And even in the, quote, private ones, I saw how people were treated, and it made me sick. And at age 12, I said to my father, I'm going to be a psychologist, and my goal in life is to keep people out of mental hospitals. That's what I want to do. I don't like prisons, and to me, a mental hospital is a prison. And it's designed to separate people rather than connect people. Connection is really important right now, not just to me. I think we all are aware of what we're needing from each other and with each other.
What would be the most important thing you'd want to say to people?
I think is to make eye contact with a stranger every day and remember to smile and to keep your heart open. We're all knots in the same macrame to honor strangers.